rather than appealing to them at the policy level first. But it also suggests somehow that Democrats are entitled to black votes. So why aren't these black men being good to the party? Why are they abandoning the party? Why aren't they doing what they're supposed to do? When in fact, black men have been the second most loyal people to the Democratic Party. If anything, they've been too loyal. Again, I'm not suggesting that people should vote for Trump. To be clear, never vote for Trump. But I am saying that there has to be a different kind of conversation, and one that finally implicates white people. Democratic presidents don't win because they get the majority of white people. They haven't, a Democratic president hasn't gotten the majority of white voters in a very, very long time. I mean, decades and decades and decades. Trump does not win because only 90% of black men voted, or only 88% of black men voted. Donald Trump wins because white people choose whiteness. Donald Trump will win this election because white people have chosen to close ranks around their whiteness rather than their political interests. When the poor white farmer or the person who's been pushed out of the labor market decides that they're going to vote for Trump and his billionaire tax breaks, when they decide that they're going to respond to xenophobia by opting in, when white women hear Donald Trump's patriarchy and the vile things he says and still decide to vote for him, they're the ones that are choosing whiteness. They're the ones that are choosing Trump. So please, for black people who have always attempted to hold this fragmented democracy together, whatever happens in this election, if Donald Trump wins, it ain't because of us.
And one sector of the electorate that's gotten very little attention are Asian Americans, who in 2020 about voted 54% for Biden. But the indications are from those polls that have specifically centered in on the millions of Asian Americans in the country that there's a much bigger margin, about 66 to 28% among Asian American and Pacific Islanders for Kamala Harris. I'm wondering your thoughts about how Asian Americans rarely get talked about.
Yeah, I think you're right. Asian American voters rarely get talked about. And when they do, they get talked about in the aggregate, kind of like we're doing right now. I mean, to think about what Korean American voters want or Japanese American voters want is very different than to think about what, say, Hmong American voters might want. And when you're in a place like Wisconsin, if you're in Milwaukee or you're in Madison, where there are Hmong populations, where there are Cambodian populations, like there are in, say, South Philadelphia, you got to say, okay, how can we reach these voters? How can we understand their needs, their economic plights, their social trajectories? They're all very different. But very often when we say Asian, we're lumping in a whole lot of people who have different ideologies, beliefs, et cetera. We sometimes do that with Latinx voters as well. But I think we do it even more so with Asian American voters. And I think that's why many politicians, not just at the national level, but at the local level, miss the mark.
I want to go to President Biden's comments facing criticism after speaking during a Voto Latino Get Out the Vote call online, condemning racist comments made about Puerto Rico at Trump's Madison Square Garden rally.
Well, the Puerto Rican that I know, or Puerto Rico, where I'm in my home state of Delaware, they're good, decent, honorable people. The only garbage I see floating out there is his supporters. His demonization of Latinos is unconscionable. And it's un-American. It's totally contrary to everything we've done.
Now, Trump and his backers seized on Biden's remarks, comparing them to Hillary Clinton in 2016, calling Trump supporters a basket of deplorables. On social media, President Biden clarified. He said his demonization, this is what Biden said, referring to Trump, his demonization of Latinos is unconscionable. That's all I meant to say. The Biden team went on to say he was talking about the supporters who spoke at the Madison Square Garden rally. But Mark Lamont Hill, if you can respond to this, you are in Philadelphia. You're in the battleground state of Pennsylvania. There is this question and a whole controversy that is swirling about in the Kamala Harris campaign, which is what to do with Biden over these last few days. He is, quote, misspeaking a lot. They're going to send him to Scranton, of course, his hometown, where he can appeal to white, blue-collar workers. But they are concerned that about his gaffes, and that we in the media are even talking about this when she has 75,000 people at her closing argument address. Talk about the importance of Pennsylvania and also Biden's role in all of this, including what's happening in Gaza.
Yeah, first, Pennsylvania absolutely is of the utmost importance. We saw that both in 2016 and in 2020. I'm not sure that either candidate or either campaign is comfortable that they can win this election if they don't feel like they're going to be competitive in Pennsylvania. Hillary Clinton lost in 2016, largely because of a very, 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 I'm talking about razor thin loss in Pennsylvania. I believe it was 55,000 votes or something in that neighborhood. And so Pennsylvania is of the utmost importance. I think sending Joe Biden to Scranton is ideal. The only two places right now, though, I would send Joe Biden are Scranton and Delaware. And Delaware obviously isn't really a contested state. So I think it's okay to send him to Scranton because he has a huge margin of error in his hometown. Other than that, I think the Harris campaign would be very wise to leave Joe Biden off of the campaign trail. He was someone who was gaffe prone in his prime. But at this moment, the very reason why he's not the nominee is the reason why he shouldn't be on the campaign trail. And that is, I'm not sure he's up for the challenge. Many people are at his age. Many people are at this level of his career in terms of being, you know, sort of emeritus level presidents. They should be on the campaign trail. But Joe Biden is in a unique position. I think that he, after taking the victory lap this summer, should step to the side and allow Kamala Harris to move forward. Also, any critiques of Joe Biden at this moment don't need to be assigned to Kamala Harris. She's already been subjected to sufficient scrutiny. I don't think bringing Joe Biden on helps at all. And then for those people who are attempting to convince themselves that Kamala Harris is different than Joe Biden on some key policy issues, particularly foreign policy issues, I don't think bringing Genocide Joe back out in the midst of an ongoing war and an escalation in Lebanon is something that will do well for voters. Again, that's not to suggest that they're different than each other, but if I'm a campaign strategist, I don't want to remind people of their similarities.
And Mark, I wanted to ask you about the day after Election Day next week, because back in the last presidential election, a year before the election, I warned on this show that my sense was that the Trump people were not going to accept whatever happened that was not in his favor, and that there was a real danger of violence and an insurrection. But my sense is that this time, it's very likely that we're not going to know for days what the final results are, and whatever it is that the Trump people are not going to accept it. Except this time, I believe what's going to happen is more localized insurrections in county election boards and at the state level, as the Trump MAGA movement had learned from their failures last time around. I'm wondering if you have a sense whether the progressive or even the traditional Democrats are really prepared for the kind of resistance that they're going to encounter from Trump's followers.
Yeah, first, yes, I think all that's going to happen. These are deplorable people. Anyone in 2024 that is willing to vote for Donald Trump is deplorable, and it's a morally indefensible position. And that claim that I'm making is supported by the extraordinary amount of violence that is being promised to be doled out all throughout the country if former President Trump becomes reelected President Trump. That is a very, very dangerous proposition. When you look at social media, when you look at the sort of underground worlds where these people often circulate, there are extraordinary promises of violence. And because Donald Trump never just stands up and says, hey, I hope that doesn't happen. I need this not to happen. I demand that it does not happen, because he doesn't do that. He gives a license to these people to make it happen. But I don't think that this is just the problem of liberal Democrats or traditional Democrats or progressives or anybody else. This is the problem of anyone who believes in freedom. Anyone who believes in safety and dignity should be fighting this, should be preventing this. And every one of us should be scared, because as we saw, even people who carry the water for Donald Trump for 4 years, as Mike Pence did, and again, one of the most morally repugnant vice presidencies we could imagine simply for being next to Trump. Even though he did all that water carrying, he was disposable to Donald Trump. Donald Trump will allow anyone to fall by the wayside if it benefits him. So no one is safe in a Trump presidency. No one is safe the day after a Trump loss. And I think we need to be very mindful of that and guard ourselves against it. And the very fact that we have to ask ourselves, are we safe if Trump loses? When was the last time there was a presidential contest that did not include Donald Trump where we were literally worried about the status of democracy or the safety of everyday people based on the winner or the loser of the election. We cause a lot of violence around the world, but we've never had to deal with that at home in the same way. We should be accountable for both. But my point here is, at the end of the day, only Donald Trump brings that kind of that kind of craziness. And it's a signpost of why maybe, just maybe, he shouldn't be leading the country.
Just to talk about the survey that Brennan just did, the Brennan Center, a survey of local election officials across the U.S. found 38% report experiencing threats, harassment, or abuse. 54% are concerned about the safety of their colleagues, according to this report released by the Brennan Center for Justice. The survey of more than 925 local election officials in February and March also found 62% are concerned about political leaders attempting to interfere with how election officials do their jobs. 13% of local officials who responded said they're concerned about facing pressure to certify results in favor of a specific candidate or party. Mark Lamont Hill, we want to thank you for being with us. We hope you'll join us for our election night special, which is on Tuesday night at democracynow.org or on your favorite public television or community radio station. We'll be broadcasting from 8 p.m. Eastern to midnight, and the next morning from 8 in the morning Eastern to 10, a two-hour special on November 6. Mark Lamont Hill, host of Upfront on Al Jazeera English, and a nightly YouTube show called Night School, also professor of anthropology and urban education at the City University of New York Graduate Center. Coming up, we look at how Republicans are blanketing the airwaves with transphobic ads ahead of Election Day. If people are watching sports, baseball or football, the Republicans are spending tens of millions of dollars in anti-trans ads. We'll speak to Amara Jones, host of the Anti-Trans Hate Machine podcast. Stay with us. Sade. This is Democracy Now! War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We look now at how Republicans are spending tens of millions of dollars, something like over $60 million, to flood the airwaves and social media with political ads that attack transgender rights. The Trump campaign is running the first ever presidential campaign ad on the topic, and the Senate Leadership Fund, backed by Mitch McConnell, is running ads in key Senate races in swing states, often during major football games.
Kamala was the first to help pay for a prisoner's sex change.
The power that I had, I used it in a way that was about pushing for the movement, frankly, and the agenda.
Kamala's agenda is they, them, not you.
But Brown voted multiple times to allow transgender biological males to participate in girls' sports.
Baldwin supported providing puberty blockers and sex change surgeries to minor children.
She even supports forcing Wisconsin women's domestic violence shelters to admit biological men who claim to identify as women.
And anti-trans attacks are a key part of Trump's message. Some say it's his closing message. At a Bronx barbershop campaign stop aired on Fox last week, Trump pivoted back to trans kids when asked how he would improve schools.
I say reading, writing, and arithmetic. No transgender, no operations. You know, they take your kid. There are some places your boy leaves the school, comes back a girl. Okay? Without parental consent. What is that all about?
For more, we're joined by Amara Jones, founder and CEO of Translash Media, host of its investigative podcast, The Anti-Trans Hate Machine, which just launched a new season about how paramilitary groups have weaponized transphobia to forge ties to Republicans and stoke political violence. Amara Jones' new piece for Newsweek is headlined, What's at Stake for Trans People in This Election, in National, State, and Local Races. Welcome back to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us, Amara. So if you can talk about the overall climate, I mean, I listened to almost every speech on Sunday at Madison Square Garden, almost every speaker, including Robert F. Kennedy, talked about trans issues. I think his line was, we're going to protect women's sports. But if you can talk about the overall climate, the tens of millions of dollars being put into ads.
Well, I'm sorry that you did that to yourself, Amy, and watched for 6 hours. I think that what we have to be very clear about is that transphobia is not just a plank, but a key pillar of the Republican Party. It has staked a large part of its argument as to why it should be in power and why it should return to power due to transphobia and due to its campaign against trans people. It's sort of that and immigration are essentially the reasons why they say that they should be reelected. And I think that for them, anti-trans hate does a couple of things. I think the first thing that it does is that it helps them continue to animate their base and to essentially give them something to focus on after abortion. For several years, they've known that abortion was going to be on the chopping block and that they had a key part of their constituency that was engaged on gender, and so they have to give that group of people something to do, essentially. Secondly, it allows them to have inroads into places and people that they would never be in conversation with. They normally wouldn't be in conversation with suburban moms who had been turned off to. They wouldn't be able to be in conversation with certain black religious people and Latinos who are evangelicals, or even some gay people, right, who are anti-trans, the so-called TERFs. So what this does is that it allows them to be able to shave off just enough votes in marginal races to eke out a win. And that's what they look at this issue as. And I think the fact that they've dropped so much money on these ads tells us that they believe that this race is extremely close or they're behind. And so what they're trying to do is to pick up one or two votes per precinct in order to win, which was Donald Trump's margin over Hillary Clinton in Michigan in 2016, for example. And the last thing that it does for them is that it cements them as a Christian nationalist party. It is the imprimatur of the fact that the Republican Party has become an extremist movement that has been taken over by the Christian nationalist movement and brands them as such and puts them in league not only with political extremists, but also paramilitary extremists, in a bid to destabilize democracy from the ground up.
Amara, I wanted to ask you, the Wall Street Journal's editorial board recently ran a piece titled Transgender Sports is a 2024 Sleeper Issue. And they especially focused on Senate races in Ohio, Montana, and Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering your response and why particularly these states that they're focusing on?
Well, those states are Republican-leading states where the Senate candidates in those states have to rely on a lot of Republican votes or independent voters who lean Republican in order to be able to win. Those are also all tight races, right? Which is where you want to deploy, from their perspective, anti-trans issues, and anti-trans hate or discomfort at a minimum. And so it is a part of that strategy of eking out votes, getting just enough, and playing to Republicans and reminding them that the candidates that they might be inclined trying to vote for in this race, you know, might be strange or somehow anti-American or in some ways just, you know, weird people to turn the phrase back on Democrats. So it's an otherization that's happening with this issue. And again, it's in these tight Senate races where these Democrats have to rely on Republican votes. And the Republican Party, in a really short amount of time, has primed its entire base to be concerned and to be focused on anti-trans issues. So they're ripe for it. You know, in the last 4 years, they have passed anti-trans laws in half of the country. And just this year, 600 anti-trans bills have been introduced, becoming more extreme each year. So this is just something that Republican voters are naturally inclined to focus on. And so if you're in a tight race and you have to rely on some Republican votes, and as a Republican, you see that the Democrat is doing that and maybe making inroads, then you want to deploy this issue as a way to bring those voters back home.
And you've also looked into how paramilitary groups have used anti-trans politics to forge closer ties to Republicans. Could you talk about what you found?
So essentially, anti-trans issues acts as an affinity point between paramilitary groups and the Republican Party. And one of the things that happened after January 6th is that these paramilitary groups saw that if you do one big thing against the national government deploys its power. But what these groups decided to do was to atomize themselves, to go local, in the words of Gavin McGinnis, who told me in an interview that that was their strategy. The founder of Proud Boys. And what he was alluding to is the fact that these groups have kept their members engaged, recruited new members, forged relationships with local politicians, Republican politicians all across the country, and continue to develop their brand by focusing on drag story hours and protesting LGBTQ events across the country. And so it seemed as if the Proud Boys and the other groups had gone away, but all they've done is gone to ground. And because they focused on LGBTQ issues, local authorities and other politicians and even the mainstream media have ignored their continued development and growing strength because they see, oh, they're just protesting, you know, drag story hours. But what they've been doing is exercising themselves and getting ready for sort of the next big events. And one of the things that we need to focus on is that SPLC last year, the Southern Poverty Law Center, which tracks extremist and extremist groups, last year did a study. And in that study, they counted more extremist groups in the United States than ever, than since they've been counting. And half of white supremacist groups, half of those groups last year engaged in anti-LGBTQ and anti-trans actions and protests and some form of violence. So these groups have used these issues in order to grow strength below the radar for whatever comes next.
I wanted to turn to the trailer for season three of your podcast, Trans Lashes, Anti-Trans Hate Machine. It follows up on this point. Paramilitary groups stoke political violence.
Hi, I'm Amara Jones. I've spent years investigating authoritarian and far-right movements. And lately, I've been alarmed by the rise in dangerous political violence across the United States. It's at levels not seen since the 1970s, and an unprecedented amount of this violence is being directed at queer and trans people.
Drag queen story time interrupted at an East Bay library. A hate crime investigation now underway.
So on this season of the Anti-Trans Hate Machine, I'm going to show how the anti-trans ecosystem has expanded its fight from legislatures and courtrooms to the streets, and what this means for all of us.
Everybody was armed that day. Everybody was carrying sidearms. Everybody had knives on display. Everybody was putting their hands on their pistol grips.
Paramilitary groups have seized upon anti-trans hate to solidify their alliance with supposedly mainstream conservatives. I'll show you how these attacks are part of a coordinated strategy to bring about a patriarchal fascist regime in America, one where queer people would be erased from public life.
If the bullets start flying, I'm covering her up, and I'm taking the bullet for her, and she'll survive. so she has to be with me.
So that's the trailer for the new season 3 of Anti-Trans Hate Machine. You talk about a lot of specifics here. Groups in Idaho who are using the state as a testing ground for a new wave of extremism. Episode 3, No Such Thing as a Lone Wolf, looks at the responses and solutions to terrorist violence fueled by anti-trans hate. You're looking at Wadsworth, Ohio. Tell us some specific stories and also how they relate to down-ballot races.
So one of the things that's happening in Idaho, there's so many examples, but in Idaho is the fact that extremist groups, paramilitary groups, have found common cause with an organization called the Idaho Freedom Foundation. And the Idaho Freedom Foundation acts as sort of this connective tissue between paramilitary groups, extremist politicians, and the promulgation of laws to make the state more extreme. And essentially what they are all doing is working to create an atmosphere of fear and intimidation at the local level, transforming what was once a right-leaning mainstream, in quotes, Republican Party, into one dominated by people who want to do things or are promoting to do things like make paramilitary groups legal in the state, to literally legalize them. And this air of intimidation means that people who are considering running for races, who may not be extremist politicians, come under threats. People who put LGBTQ signs or pro anything other than, you know, what Christian nationalists want in their yards. One person drove up to a person that we interviewed and told her when she put an LGBTQ sign in her yard, thanks for putting that sign in your yard because we know where to shoot when the bullets fly. And so what this is doing is using the paramilitary groups as a way of shifting the comfort level with democracy, with making your voice heard at the democratic level, and therefore getting more and more extreme politicians there. And they're working and also signaling with places like Libs of TikTok, which put out a call around an LGBTQ event in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. And that event in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, drew in Patriot Front, who was there to stoke violence that day, as a part of what an Idaho Freedom Foundation politician had called for in terms of protesting that event. And the problem with Idaho is that it's a petri dish for these conditions, where we are starting to see it occur in other places like Tennessee, where Patriot Front is beginning to make more and more of a show of force. It's passed more anti-trans laws than any other state in the country. And so what we're seeing is this affinity. I mean, even in places like New York City, where the Proud Boys are increasingly allying with certain believe it or not, Republican members of the city council around drag story hour events here. So what is happening is that being anti-trans is a signal for extremists as to who's on their side, and that signal then allows them to work together to push the country more and more to its extremes.
And Mara, I wanted to ask you, there's been a lot of attention focused on Project 2025 by the Democrats, but could you talk about the central place that anti-trans ideology plays in Project 2025?
Well, you can't understand Project 2025 without understanding or grasping the Republican Party's obsession with trans people and with transphobia. As a matter of fact, anti-trans sentiment and anti-trans, ideas are on page one of Project 2025, going into page two. It's literally on the first page. And essentially, Project 2025, with its weaponization of government, is essentially taking all of the learnings that the Trump administration garnered from its anti-trans policies, where it learned how to weaponize the government against a group of people in healthcare, in the military, in education, attempted in housing, and essentially then took those learnings findings and then apply them to Project 2025. As a matter of fact, one of the key architects of Trump's anti-trans policies, Roger Severino, is one of the key people who drafted and wrote Project 2025. And to close the loop, you know, he and other people were at the Heritage Foundation, came into the Trump administration with these policies, and are now carrying them through, applying them to many people through Project 2025.
Well, we want to thank you for being with us also. This is a case we'll look at in the coming days. The Supreme Court will soon hear a landmark legal challenge brought by the ACLU against a ban on hormone therapies for transgender youth. It'll be argued by Chase Strangio, making Chase Strangio the first openly transgender lawyer to argue before the Supreme Court. Amara Jones, thanks so much for being with us. Founder and CEO of Translash Media, host of its investigative podcast, The Anti-Trans Hate Machine. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.